When his victim fell to the floor, Sheldon took his hat from the hand of the wounded man and coolly walked away. He was subsequently arrested and locked up at the Chestnut Street Station. Sheldon is also known as Stag Lee.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum, discussing the folklore of violence. I'm Jamie Paglia, program manager of the Forum. For hundreds of years, violence and outlaws have been celebrated through song. Leading our exploration of the folklore of violence is James Sparky Rucker. Sparky Rucker is an internationally acclaimed singer, musician, storyteller, and folklorist. In 35 years of performing, he has made over a dozen recordings and offers workshops around the country on African-American folk history and multicultural American history. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, Sparky Rucker.
I love making titles for things. It's kind of a hobby with me to try to say everything in one line. Bullies, Bad Men, and the Blues. The culture of violence in the African-American ballad tradition. Most African-American ballads, indeed most American ballads, were penned or made up between 1875 and 1900. In fact, I've had numerous African-American songsters tell me in answer to my question of when did you write this song, they said, I didn't write it. I made it up, suggesting that there was no pen or pencil involved. Very literal. This phenomenon could be explained in a number of ways, such as the end of manifest destiny and the idea of the frontier, thereby recreating this frontier in song and legend. It can also be explained that the African-American ballad tradition only flourished after the emancipation in the year of Jubilo in 1865, 10 years hence. This era gave rise to such legends as Pecos Bill and John Henry. There were also real character legends such as Stagger Lee, John Hardy, Casey Jones, Jesse James, Wild Bill Hickok, Wyatt Earp, Annie Oakley, and Buffalo Bill. Most of these larger-than-life characters took on a monumental proportions and some elicited ballads about them. The first of these legends I'd like to examine is Stacko Lee or Stagger Lee. My first knowledge of Stagger Lee was when I first saw my cousin Jefferson Robert Ross III come out into the auditorium stage of Beardsley Junior High School in Knoxville, Tennessee. He was dressed in black jeans and leather jacket with the collar turned up, a la Elvis Presley. Dark sunglasses and a cat pistol as he lip-synced the words to soul singer Lloyd Price's song, Stagger Lee. The girls were screaming in ecstasy, at least as much as junior high school girls at that time could experience ecstasy. One could almost imagine a flash forward into the future and experiencing the same thrill while watching Arnold Schwarzenegger mouthing the words, I'll be back, in his persona as the Terminator. We all knew that Stagger Lee was a bad man. When the Civil War reached its inevitable conclusion, the country went back to its prime directive of manifest destiny. The vision of a nation that stretches from sea to shining sea was the driving factor in this enterprise. In fact, the Civil War and its surplus of hand weapons is one of the reasons that the Wild West became wild. Getting to the frontier was always a problem, and once a settlement was established, the problem was then and there how to set up trade and resupply. Before the rail system changed the course of the Industrial Revolution, early settlers used the rivers and streams to haul large cargo loads. River traffic clogged the natural waterways of our nation, and from this there grew a remarkable culture. The main river which influenced our growth was the mighty Mississippi. Its early European explorers were the Arcadian French Canadians. With the fur trade in full swing at that time, the French explorers, called voyageurs, were seen to ply their trade routes up and down the Mississippi. They established posts along the way with names like La Crosse, Prairie du Chien, Dubuque, St. Louis, Cape Girardeau, Baton Rouge, and New Orleans. With these towns dotting the landscape along the Mississippi, the culture had a decided French quality. The name of these Arcadians was southernized into Cajuns, and they plied their trade with efficiency. After the Civil War, this system once again flourished, and it helped to strengthen another culture, the river culture. This consisted of captains, pilots, hands, gamblers, show people, and loaders or stevedores. In the Mississippi River town of St. Louis lived a black man who worked as a stevedore. As he and his comrades worked loading and unloading the paddle wheelers, they would often stack these items on the dock in preparation for the arrival of the next riverboat. They would stack this cargo out of the wind and rain on the lee side of the dock. These stevedores became known as Stacko Lees. The name was changed through time and legend became Stacko Lee or Stagger Lee. There is some evidence that Stagger Lee really existed. One version has it that he was a Confederate cavalryman, son of a great old river captain, a steamboat officer, and a powerful, loving man. An article in the St. Louis Globe Dispatch said he lived in St. Louis and owned a home there, which still exists. And I'll quote you from this newspaper article. St. Louis Globe Dispatch, December 28, 1895. Shot in Curtis's place. William Lyons, 25, colored, a Levi hand living at 1410 Morgan Street, was shot in the abdomen yesterday evening at 10 o'clock in the saloon of Bill Curtis at 11th and Morgan Streets by Lee Sheldon, also colored. Both parties, it seems, had been drinking and were feeling in exuberant spirits. Lyons and Sheldon were friends and were talking together. The discussion drifted to politics. Ah, another reason to fight, of course. And an argument was started, the conclusion of which that Lyons snatched Sheldon's hat from his head. The latter indignantly demanded its return. Lyons refused, and Sheldon withdrew his revolver and shot Lyons in the abdomen. Lyons was taken to the dispensary where his wounds were pronounced serious. He was removed to the city hospital. At the time of the shooting, the saloon was crowded with Negroes. Sheldon is a carriage driver and lives at 911 North 12th Street. When his victim fell to the floor, Sheldon took his hat from the hand of the wounded man and coolly walked away. He was subsequently arrested and locked up at the Chestnut Street station. Sheldon is also known as Stag Lee. This is a direct quote from the newspaper. So we find the exact incident that created this particular ballot. And it goes on to say that they had the trial and it resulted in a hung jury amidst major political controversy. He was convicted in the second trial, served time, and died during the 19 teens. The judge also said that Lee Sheldon had gone to a hoodoo woman and obtained a spell to increase his sexual powers. Oh, yes, you got to do that now. Nowadays, they call that voodoo spell Viagra. Yes, indeed. Yeah. The talisman for that spell was his Stetson hat. And this was well known in the community, so when Lyons snatched the hat off of it, it was a serious insult indeed. This legend of a man who was a powerful gambler, lover, and fighter captured the imagination of many Southern blacks. In another version of the story, a young Cajun named Billy DeLion tried his mettle against Old Stag. And when legal matters didn't suffice, he resorted to cheating and tried to claim Stagger Lee's magic Stetson hat. Stagger Lee pulls a cap and ball .44 pistol, levels it at Billy, who pleads in vain for his life. Shots rang out, and Billy lay dead on the floor in the barroom, basically following the story in the newspaper. In some versions of the ballad, he even defeats the devil. I mean, they get real carried away with this thing. In the 1950s, of course, the rhythm and blues version was recorded by Lloyd Price after he heard Mississippi John Hurt's version. Another bad man was an Alabama turpentine worker. Now, to understand this turpentine thing, North Alabama is mostly pine and wood hills, and back in the late 1800s, there were a lot of turpentine factories there. In fact, there are actually two bad men ballads that arose from the turpentine era, one being the one I'm going to talk about, and the other is a song called Railroad Bill, because he was also a turpentine worker in North Alabama. According to the legends, this fellow, whose name was Lazarus, worked and lived in the piney wood mountains of northern Alabama working in the turpentine mills. Some dispute over pay caused Lazarus to tear up the place and walk the table, a practice of jumping upon the dinner table at the factory and walking its length, placing one's foot in every plate. He then broke into the commissary and stole the payroll. This would, of course, have caused a riot, and for this action, the high sheriff was called into the arrest of poor Lazarus. The sheriff sent out his deputies and cornered Lazarus up between two mountains where they gunned him down. They hauled his remains back to the commissary where they laid him out and sent for his family, but he apparently died before they could get there. And just a couple of lines from the song. And they found poor Lazarus They found him up between two mountains, and they blowed him down. Oh, Lord, and they blowed him down. And what they used was a great big number. Number 44. Oh, Lord, cold 44. So once again, just the whole thing of trying to elicit the good feelings about somebody having died. In the ballot, Betty tells Dupree, "I want a diamond ring." Dupree has no choice in his answer as he responds, "I'll buy you most anything." But as he is indigent, the next line rejoins, "He took his pistol, went to the jewelry store." There he shot a policeman and wounded four or five more. The result, of course, is in "Paying the Piper," as the ending goes, "Up the steps to the scaffold, black cloth o'er his head. Today Betty will be free, poor Dupree will be dead." Once again, the haves against the have-nots, resulting in a violent conclusion. This violence in the genre was not confined to men, as Delia Holmes will attest. The majority of the ballad is concerned with the elaborate funeral a la St. James Infirmary, the Dying Crapshooter's Blues. However, early in the song, you know that Curly, other versions say Cooney, shot poor Delia with his trusty .44. The last of these ballads which I will examine is about Alabama badman Morris Slater, that I mentioned before, known throughout the Southeast region as Railroad Bill. Slater terrorized the Louisville-Nashville Railroad on its Alabama and Florida routes from 1894 to 1897. In the course of Slater's reign of terror, he ambushed Sheriff E.S. McMillan's special train and killed him with his .38 special on a .45 frame, which meant didn't have much recoil, so he was able to get off more accurate shots. However, McMillan's body, or the train, was never found. J.B. Harlan was the special detective agent for the Ellen Railroad, and he led the hunt which tracked down Slater and shot him dead in Tidmore's store in Atmore, Alabama, on March the 7th, 1897. According to legend, Slater was assuaging his hunger with crackers and cheese when he was shot two times and two times more. I mean, man, poor man can't even get crackers and cheese without somebody coming in shooting him, you know? In the people's mind, Railroad Bill was a Robin Hood figure in the same vein as Jesse James, robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. The ballad actually began to be composed as the events were taking place. It is fraught with violent verses such as, "Buy me a pistol just as long as my arm, kill everybody, done me harm," or the vivid images of Bill as he shot the buttons off the sheriff's coat and shot the lantern out of the brakeman's hand. The chilling McMillan images were especially disturbing as he killed McMillan like a lightning flash with a gun in each hand. After his death, he was embalmed, given a special viewing train, and exhibited throughout the South at 50 cents a view. Legend has it that at one stop, McMillan's son, while passing in review of the body, forced Slater's dead jaws apart and inserted bitterweed into his mouth, yelling in defiance, "Here's to the man that murdered my pa!" Supposedly, he scratched his hand on Slater's teeth, got blood poisoning, and died. Railroad Bill, Railroad Bill, he never worked, Lord, and he never will. It's right, right, right.
You are joining us at Cambridge Forum, listening to Sparky Rucker discussing the folklore of violence. What purpose does writing or singing a song about an outlaw specifically serve for a given population versus a song more about common man blues?
Well, you must remember that this country was settled by type A people. And I mean, and this is something that as I look more and more into it, I see it in every culture that came to this country, be it the Europeans who left whatever, whether they thought it was bad or not, but it was what they knew to come to the frontier. You had if you believe in the Bering Strait theory, a lot of my Native American friends don't, but following the caribou from Siberia into the unknown, hoping that you're going to get there and there'll be some place to live, something to eat, and to fight for what little things there were there, to the survival from the Middle Passage, the two-month-long journey to this country from West Africa in chains. We are all descended from type A people. which explains our thirst for the frontier, our thirst for fighting for what is ours. And it comes out in every aspect of our culture. I mean, what's the most popular show on cable? The Sopranos. And it's talking about a very violent form of culture, subculture within that community. And so when in the blues songs, which also have some violence in them, by the way, and they usually are about either gambling or women or drinking or a combination of all three. But in the ballad tradition, be it the old English ballads to the ones in this country, from the banks of the Ohio to St. James Infirmary to the streets of Laredo, and they're all forms of the same song, which is basically the one that I read you about, which was Delia, which is about the rake, the unfortunate rake, the good person going bad and having to use violence as a way to achieve their ends.
The floor is now open for your questions and comments. Please use the microphone.
Sparky, could you illustrate that with another song by any chance?
Just happen to have a guitar here, hopefully tuned. You know, of all the songs that I could have illustrated this with, I do think the one that we're mostly all familiar with would be Stagger Lee. In fact, as I look out in the audience, I see most people are younger than me, but around my age, and remember Lloyd Price's version, we all dance at sock hops to that song. But I do require the audience to help me with this. When I say he was a bad man, you say bad man. Talking about Stagger Lee, talking about that bad man. Hey, mean old Stagger Lee. I was standing on the corner when I heard my bulldog bark. He was barking at the two men who were gambling in the dark. It was a bad man. They call him Stagger Lee, talking about that bad man. Hey, cruel old Stagger Lee. It was Stagger Lee, Billy DeLine. Two men who gamble late, you know that Stagger Lee threw seven. But Billy swore that he threw eight, trying to cheat that bad man. Trying to cheat old Stagger Lee, trying to cheat that bad man. I'm talking about Stagger Lee. Well, Stagger Lee told Billy DeLine, I can't let you go with that, son. You done won all of my money, trying to take my Stetson hat. I'm a bad man. That's why they call me Stagger Lee, talking about that bad man. That cruel old Stagger Lee. Well, you know Stagger Lee, child, he went home. He got his 44, said, I'm gonna go downtown to that barroom just to pay that debt I owe. I'm such a bad man. They call me Stagger Lee, talking about that bad man. Hey, cruel old Stagger Lee. You know Stagger Lee went to that bar. He stood across the barroom door. He said, nobody move. Then he pulled his 44. He's such a bad man. They call him Stagger Lee, talking about that bad man. Hey, mean old Stagger Lee. Stagger Lee cried, Billy DeLine, please don't take my life. I got three little children and a darling sickly wife. Don't shoot me, bad man. Don't kill me, Stagger Lee, don't you shoot me, bad man. Talk about Stagger Lee. Hey, boom, 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 daddy, boom, daddy, boom. When that 44, you know that Billy DeLine fell stone cold dead up on the barroom floor, shot by the bad man. He was shot by Stagger Lee, shot by that bad man. Oh, cruel old Stagger Lee, you know that it could be on a rainy morning, could be on a rainy night. Children, Stagger Lee and Billy DeLine got in a great big fight talking about that bad man. Talking about Stagger Lee, talking about that bad man. Mean old Stagger Lee.
talking about that bad man. Talking about Stagger Lee.
Well, one common theme seems to be that the moral order of the universe is challenged or broken, and then violence occurs as a result, and the mortar order is righted. Like Stagger Lee sort of cheats, and then, you know, he has to die. Maybe that's sort of the social, one of the social functions of these ballads, sort of to be teaching this moral lesson to people that if you break the moral code, there will be violence and you will pay, because the moral order of the universe will inevitably be righted.
We have to remember the period of time that we're discussing. Code duello up until about the time of the Civil War was very much in force. Even when it was against the law, it was still winked at. There was always some place you could go that the authorities would not come and stop you from holding this duel to protect your honor. And this is something that we still, in this culture that seems not to have much honor, but there's a part of us inside that wants to go right in justice. At least if you grew up the way I did, looking at the Disney things, you know, with the Robin Hood and Davy Crockett, and it's always the strong protect the weak, and a lot of times that is where that comes from. But you know we can talk about this ad infinitum, because as 13 Corinthians 2nd chapter says, we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face, meaning, you know, we can only surmise what is the real meaning that things happen. But, you know, and so we impose our Judeo-Christian ethic on to things to give it the meaning, to try to say that this is why the violence happens, it has to have this meaning. But I basically think, like I say, it's just testosterone running wild, giving us, just an overflow of that energy.
Forgive me, folks, but a lot of the traditional ballads show violence by families against their own daughters or sisters for making a mistake. Or, like that one example you gave, a man in the end killing his own lover who stood by him through everything, even against her own family, the Ballad of the Johnston Family, because he was crazy. It's curious to me, because I could do a whole thing on that. I work with youth in inner cities and all that, and I think we have to transcend. Okay, that's my answer to testosterone, transcendence. But you sing about these heroes and, you know, these outlaws and whatever. That's a song you sing, and you can do it, and it's okay. And I'm thinking, how does that go down?
In terms of the whether or not, I know you didn't come in at the start, but the whole thing of this was discussing how the violence has shown itself in these songs. I don't believe in throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I'll tell you the honest truth about it. That's why I also will lead workshops in the history of the minstrel show, which in this country did, in some aspects of it, have a put down on black society. But it was white men imitating black men. And then later on, it was black men imitating white men. Black men actually putting on blackface in those things, because that was the genre as it had come to be known. Yet still, say, well, we can't sing any of those songs, but, you know, there's still the history that's there, and this is how it was recorded. So you do want to study this, even though you may not agree with everything in it. You don't want to lose what's there to learn. And so, yes, it's always a balancing act, which is one of the reasons I always pray before a concert, because I know the power that I have when I'm in front of an audience as opposed to me talking one-on-one. And I never want to abuse that power. And that's why I do preach and tell stories before I sing the songs, because I want to give you the whole story, because I think people are intelligent enough to make up their own minds.
Putting aside the issue of whether this folklore is pathological or recreational, can you fast forward to the present and just reflect on the impact of this folklore violence on the contemporary music scene? I mean, do today's songs and do today's songwriters still show the violence?
Well, this is something I've had to deal with on a personal note. So I'll talk about two people. One is my friend Lonnie Pitchford, who was a fine Delta blues man from the Mississippi region, young man. In fact, I met him when he was 16, so in my mind, he's always 16. Of course, he lived to be 50 years old and died because he tried to live the life of the people he was singing the songs about. He just drank himself to death, basically. And I remember when he and I were on tour in Europe together in 83, and he was saying, you know, I don't care how much they pay me, just give me some whiskey and I'll sing. I said, Lonnie, you know, you don't have to live the life of Robert Johnson to sing his songs. You know, you can be more intelligent than that. The other person is Tupac Shakur, a very, very brilliant lyricist. I mean, look at the poem he wrote for his mother. I don't know if you ever, that Dear Mother thing, that thing clutches my heart every time I hear it. I mean, he really had a depth of understanding. He was a good actor, yet and still, because of the whole gangster rap thing, he lived that life. Karen Heat, I'm a firm believer, if you carry a gun, you're going to use it. Mm-hmm. In general, you're going to use it against somebody you love, not somebody that you're trying to defend yourself against. I mean, you know, we're going backwards. There's several states now that have passed this law that's okay if you own a gun and you have a license for it, you can carry it concealed, which means now instead of someone, just like they you know, people say, well, it's not guns that kill people, it's people that kill people. No, it's people that kill people with guns is what it is. Because if that kid in those high schools that had to come to school with a baseball bat to vent his frustration instead of coming armed to the teeth, maybe one or two people had broken arms and this kid would still be alive and that whole community wouldn't have mourned. I'm sorry, people. We got to live the reality. You don't need an AK-47 to go hunting deer. You don't need, you know, a handgun is for killing people. That's what it's for. It's not for anything else. It's for killing people. Let's look at the reality of it, you know.
Sparky, would you mind taking us out with a song?
Taking us out, boy. You know, in some communities, that means me to pull out a gun. I'll do a little bit of the Poor Lazarus. Well, the high sheriff, he told his deputies, he said, go out and bring me Lazarus. Bring him dead or alive. Oh, Lord, bring him dead or alive. And the deputies began to wonder just where in the world they could find him. Well, I don't know. Well, oh, Lord. Well, I just don't know. They found poor Lazarus. They found him up between two mountains and they blowed him down. Well, oh, oh, Lord, and they blowed him down. And what they used was a great big number 44. Well, oh, oh, Lord.
You have been listening to a program of Cambridge Forum, a free public forum in Harvard Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, co-sponsored by the First Parish in Cambridge, Unitarian Universalist, the Lowell Institute, and the Friends of Cambridge Forum. For an audio cassette of this program entitled The Folklore of Violence, send a check or money order for $12 to Cambridge Forum, 3 Church Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02138, or visit us on the web at www.cambridgeforum.org. Thank you for joining us.
Come a next payday. Whoa, oh, Lord, come a next payday.